great gates to close. My race were using the universe as an enormous whorehouse. I rerouted the prime power source to feed the lesser and middle gates. But all power sources are finite, even those that flow from collapsed stars and make up the Sipstrasse. It is in the now that you inhabit, running to its finish. There are other sources, and I will teach you to find and realign them. And then the gates will return. The man you see now is but the last fading spark of a bright fire. He will die tonight, and yet he will not be dead. We will meet again, and he shall teach you. There is a cave behind this abbey, a chalice carved upon the entrance. Let the master of the queen's men continue, and on the appointed day walk into the chalice cave and approach the far wall. It will appear as solid rock, but you will pass through it, for this gate has not vanished, but only shifted. On the other side, I shall be waiting. But you are dying. We are speaking of events which have already happened, my boy. I was working upon a complex formula in my study when the gateway flickered and you appeared. You told me that I had sent you, and you told me why. More I cannot say. The old man sighed, then gave a weak smile. We are to be great friends, you and I, closer than father and son. And yet I must say farewell to a stranger who is yet to be my friend. Ah, the tricks time plays. The old man fell silent, and his eyes closed. Casaulin sat beside him, his mind tired, his burdens heavy. Was the abbot to be trusted? How could he tell? The future of his people rested with the promise of a dying monk. He sat with Astolay until dawn's first light seeped through the wooden shutters of the window. Then he lifted the abbot's hand from his arm. Casaulin stood and gazed down at the old man. He was dead. The clansman lifted the blanket and pulled it over the abbot's face, pausing to study the man's expression. A faint smile was on the lips, and a great feeling of peace swept over Casaulin. He walked to the window, pulling open the shutters. The woods beyond shone in the early morning light. Behind him the door opened, and the Lancer Bedwyr stepped into the room.
Did you find what you hoped for, Red Hawk?
Time will tell.
The old man died, then,
said the Lancer, glancing at the bed. Yes, peacefully.
They say he knew great magic. Does that mean his spirit will return to haunt us?
I certainly hope so, said Casaulin. Unaware of the growing drama, Galen led the Hasten woman northwest, stopping only to meet the Palades warriors. The 80-man force had now swelled to 110, as other warriors crept in from the mountains and woods where they had hidden their families, in derelict crofts or well-disguised caves. 10 men were to be left behind to hunt and gather food for the hidden children, but the others were set to follow Galen. The young clansman was truly concerned now, for he had never led such a force, and was worried about the route. He conferred with Agwain, Onik, and Gwalchmai. It was one thing for a small party to thread its way through the Aenir lines, quite another for an army numbering almost 1,000.
"We know," said Onik, "that the main army is before us pushing north. We should have no real trouble for at least 2 days.
"You were forgetting Orsa," said Galen. "His forces destroyed Larrick in the south. We don't know if he will head north now and join his father. If he does, we will be trapped between them."
"Ifs and buts, cousin," said Agwain. "We will solve nothing by such discussion.
We are expected at Axter Glen, and one way or another we must move on. We cannot eliminate all risks.
True, admitted Galen, but it is as well to examine them.
So be it.
We will head due north, and then cut west to Atta, and then on to the glen. That way we should avoid Orsa, but we'll push out a screen of scouts west and east, and you, Gwal, shall go ahead of us in the north with 5 men to scout.
The self-appointed leader of the Pallades, a burly clansman named Tellor, caused Galen's first problem.
Why should you lead and make such decisions?
He asked when Galen told him of the plan.
I lead because I was appointed to lead. I follow Magrig.
Magrig follows Caswallon.
So you see, blood eye.
Galen breathed deeply, pushing aside his anger. He rubbed his scarred eye, aware that Lara and the others were watching this encounter with detached fascination. Such was the way of warriors among the clans. Tellor had now implied that Galen was a liar, and the 2 men were hovering on the verge of combat.
Your land, said Galen at last, has been overrun by an enemy. Your people are sundered, and preparing to fight alongside the Farlan in a last desperate battle for survival. If they lose, we lose everything. And yet here you are debating a point of no importance. Now I will say this only once. I lead because I was chosen to lead. There is no more to discuss. Either draw your sword or obey me.
Very well, said Tellor. I will follow you north, but once the battle is sighted, I will lead the Pallades.
No, said Galen. The man's sword hissed from his scabbard.
Then fight me, Farlan.
The onlookers backed away, forming a circle around the 2 men.
I do not desire to kill you, said Galen hopelessly. Then I lead.
No, said Galen softly, drawing his sword.
You die.
Wait, shouted Lara, stepping forward with hands on hips. It is well known that the Farlan are arrogant numbskulls, and that the Pallades have too long interbred with their cattle. But this is sheer stupidity. If you must fight, then fight. But let it be clear that if Galen conquers, then he leads all.
And what if Tellor wins?
Asked a young Pallades warrior.
Then he leads the Pallades alone, said Lara. I'll not follow a man with the brain of a turnip.
You miserable Hasten butch, snapped Taylor.
You seek to rob the contest of any merit.
It has no merit, said Galen.
Thousands of clansmen and their wives lie butchered by invaders, and you seek to add more clan blood to the soil.
Taylor gave a harsh laugh.
Frightened, are you, Farlan?
Galen shook his head. Terrified, he said, dropping his sword and stepping forward, his forehead thundering against Taylor's nose. The Pallades warrior staggered back, blood drenching his yellow beard, as Galen moved in with a left cross exploding against Taylor's unprotected chin. The Pallades warrior pitched to his left, hitting the ground hard. Galen rolled the man to his back and drew his hunting knife, touching the point to Taylor's throat.
Make a choice, live or die, he said coldly.
Taylor lay very still.
Love,
he whispered.
The first wise choice you've made, said Galen.
Rising, he gripped the man's right arm, hauling him to his feet. Taylor staggered, but remained upright, blood dripping from his ruined nose.
Now, pick 20 Pallades to follow Agwain and Onik. I want scouts east and west of us. Then you go, the 3 of your choosing, to the north to make sure our route is clear. Is that understood?
Taylor nodded. Turning on his heel, Galen set off, and the small army followed him. Lara moved up alongside him, grinning.
That was close, she said.
Yes. Thank you for your help. It took away his concentration.
It was nothing. I didn't want Taylor to cut your ears off. He's second only to Intosh with a bleed.
Then I thank you again, with even more feeling.
Are you a good swordsman?
I've
recently learned to tell the point from the hilt. No, truly. I am as good as most men.
Have you killed any Aeneir?
Yes. How many?
Gods, woman, what does it matter?
I like to know who I'm following.
I've killed 5 and wounded another.
5? It's not bad.
Hand to hand or with the bow?
Hand to hand. The wounded man I hit with an arrow.
Marksmanship, not your strong point, then?
No.
And you?
What about me?
Well, we seem to be talking about numbers killed, so I am asking you the same question.
I see.
Why?
Because I like to know the calibre of my followers, said Galen, grinning.
I haven't killed any, but I will.
I don't doubt it.
Do you have a woman? She asked suddenly.
No.
Why?
She refused me.
I see,
said Lara.
What do you see?
I see why you're so nervous around women.
I am not nervous around women.
I am nervous around you, he said.
Why is that?
Galen was growing hot and beginning to feel like a hunted rabbit.
Well,
she pressed.
I have no idea, and I don't wish to discuss it,
he said primly. She laughed then, the sound deep and throaty, which only added to his discomfort. On the first night of camp, Galen avoided her, talking long into the night with Gwalchmai, who had returned from his scouting trip with Taylor. Taylor and his companions had remained in the north, and Gwal was due to rejoin them at first light.
It was an uncomfortable day, said Gwalchmai. I think we only exchanged 3 words.
I'm sorry, Gwal. How does it look? So far, the route is clear. That Taylor gives me cold chills, though.
Yes. Let's hope he saves his anger for the Aeneir.
Let's hope they cut his damned heart out, muttered Agwain, joining them.
Galen shook his head. No wonder the clans are always at war, he said.
How are you getting on with Lara? Asked Agwain, his mouth spreading in a lecherous grin.
What does that mean? Snapped Galen.
She likes you, man. It's obvious.
I don't want to talk about it.
She's gorgeous, isn't she? Not beautiful exactly, but gorgeous. And those breeches.
Will you stop this?
I wish she liked me.
I cannot believe this conversation is taking place. We are marching towards a battle. I'm trying to think about tactics, and all you can think about is breeches.
What about breeches?
Asked Lara, moving up to sit with him.
Yes, Galen, tell her about the breeches tactic, said Gwalchmai.
Galen closed his eyes.
Well, she said,
you're the authority, Gwal. You explain it.
Gwalchmai chuckled.
No, if I'm to be with Taylor by dawn, I'd best tuck up in my blankets. Excuse me.
Gwal moved off to fashion a bed below an overhanging pine. Agwain grinned and also moved away, despite Galen's imploring gaze.
So, said Lara, what about breeches?
It was a jest.
The clouds are bunching. There could be rain tomorrow.
Come with me, she said, taking his hand. He followed her into the trees and they stopped some 40 paces away, in a circular clearing screened by dense bushes. She led him to where she had placed her blankets and pulled him down beside her. The clansman was supremely ill at ease.
What did you want to talk about?
He asked huskily.
I don't want to talk, Galen.
Leaning forward, she curled an arm around his neck and kissed him. Thoughts of Diva vanished like ice on fire. Leofas and Magrig walked the length of the folly as darkness gathered around them. The slopes on either side were steep and pitted with rocks and boulders, while the pass itself showed a steady incline towards the narrow centre. The Aeneir would be charging uphill, and that would slow them, but not by much. The two men were joined by Patris Grigor and a dozen of his archers.
It's a magnificent killing ground,
said Grigor,
They'll lose hundreds before they reach you. If they come in, that is. What if they bottle up the mouth of the pass?
We attack them, declared Magrig.
That's not much of a plan, said Grigor, grinning.
I'm not much of a planner, admitted Magrig. But I think they'll come at us. They've yet to learn fear.
When your arrows are exhausted, we leave, if we can, said Grigor.
Understood,
said Magrig, walking back towards the campfires in the wide pass beyond. The walls of the Box Canyon rose sheer, reflecting the red light from hundreds of small fires. Leofas, who had remained silent on the long walk, sat back on a boulder, staring out over the clan army as they rested. Some men were already sleeping, others were sharpening sword blades, many were laughing and talking.
"What's wrong, my friend?" Magrig asked.
Leofas glanced up. In the flickering firelight, Magrig's beard shone like flames, his blue eyes glittering, his face a mask of bronze.
"I'm tired,"
said Leofas, resting his chin in his hands and staring out over the campfires.
"Nonsense! You'll be leading the victory dance tomorrow like a first-year huntsman."
The fallen warrior looked up, eyes blazing.
"Will you stop for a moment? I'm not a first-year huntsman, and I don't need you trying to lift me. I'm old, experienced. I've seen war and death. Anyone who can tell a sword point from a hole in the ground knows we have little chance tomorrow."
"Then leave," snapped Magrig.
"And where would I go, Magrig? No, I don't mind dying alongside you. In fact, I don't mind dying. My hope is that we cull their ranks enough for the other clans to have a chance of defeating them." "You think I've been foolish?"
asked Magrig, slumping beside him.
"No. We ran out of choices, that's all."
For a time they sat in silence. Then Magrig turned to his companion.
"Do you mind if I ask you a personal question?"
"I don't mind if you ask," said Leofas. "I may not answer."
"Why did you never remarry? You were only a young man when Mary died."
Leofas switched his gaze to the stars, and the years slipped away like falling dreams. He shook his head. Finally he spoke, his voice soft, his eyes distant.
"I miss her most at sunset, when we'd go to the ridge behind the house. There was an old elm there. I built a seat around the base, and we'd sit there and watch the sun die. I'd wrap us both in my cloak, and she'd rest her head on my shoulder. It was so peaceful. You could believe there was not another living being in the world. I felt alive then. I never have since." "So, why not remarry?"
"I didn't want anyone else."
"And you?"
"No one else would have me," said Magrig.
"That's not true."
"No, it's not," admitted Magrig. "But then, Rihanna and I didn't watch many sunsets. In truth, we spent most of our life together squabbling and rowing. But she was a good lass for all that. Meg was 4 when Rihanna died. She wouldn't have taken to another mother."
"We are a pair of fools," said Leofas again.
"Do you regret not having sons?"
"No,"
lied Magrig.
"And we're getting maudlin. Old men are allowed to get maudlin. It's a rule of life. We're not that old. I'm as strong as ever."
"I'm 10 years older than you, Magrig, and according to tradition that makes me wise. Between us we muster a century or more. That's old."
"I never used to be old," said Magrig, grinning. "Strange how it creeps upon a man."
They let the silence grow, each drifting on a river of memories. It was, they believed, their last night alive under the stars. And neither wanted to talk about tomorrow.
Drada was angry, more angry than he could ever recall. The clans had mounted a series of raids, retreating always to the east. He sensed a plan behind the attacks, and now it had become clear. That morning, Aeneas scouts had reported a movement of the clans towards a pass 6 miles east. Drada, who had scouted the land personally some days before, knew that the pass was blocked and impassable to the north. Surely the clans would not consider a battle there. But they had. And now the Aeneas force was waiting in the mouth of Icairn's folly. And Drada was crimson with rage.
But why attack, father? It is unnecessary. There is no way out for them. If we wait, they must attack us.
I command here,
thundered Asbadag.
Why do you plead caution when we have them where we want them?
Listen to me, father. The slopes within could hold 1,000 archers. They will take a huge toll. The main army will be near the center of the pass, where the mountain walls narrow, which means our weight of numbers will be lessened. We will be fighting 1-to-1. Of course we'll win, but we could lose thousands in there.
They brought me Barsa's rotting corpse this morning, said Asbadag. Now I have 2 sons calling for vengeance, and you want me to sit and wait?
The clans have made a terrible mistake, said Drada. They are hoping we will do exactly what you are planning. It is their only hope.
What are you, a prophet now? How do you know what they are planning? I believe we have surprised them in their lair. Get the men ready to charge.
Drada swallowed his anger, and it tasted of bile. He turned away from his father then, so that he would not see the burning hatred in his eyes.
You are dead, Asbadag, Drada decided. After the battle, I will kill you.
The Aeneas line assembled in the mouth of the pass, shield straps being tightened, sword hands rubbed in dust for better grip. 25,000 men peered at the rock-strewn slopes and the towering mountain walls beyond. There was no enemy in sight. The war horns of the Aeneas sounded, and the armor-clad mass began to move slowly forward, Drada and Tostig together at the center, Asbadag's other sons to the left and right of them. Asbadag himself stayed at the mouth of the pass, surrounded by his 40 huskarls. Morgasa stood beside him, her eyes bright, her heart hammering as she waited for the killing to begin. The Aeneas army moved on warily, with shields held high, scanning the slopes. Ahead of them, the pass narrowed, and still there was no sign of the enemy. Suddenly, the folly was alive with noise, as the Farlan and the Pallades moved into sight to man the narrow center. A great roar went up from the Aeneas as they surged forward, beating shields with their sword blades. On either side of them rose archers from the Dunnilds and the Loda. Goose-feathered shafts filled the air. The screams of wounded men rose above the war cries, and now the clans roared out their own battle cry, which echoed in the mountains, booming and growing. Dark clouds of hissing death flashed into the Aeneas horde in a series of withering volleys. Some warriors broke from the ranks to charge the archers, but these were cut down by scores of shafts. The charge slowed, but did not stop. At the front of the Aeneas line, the giant Orsa felt the Barazark rage upon him. Hurling aside his shield, he raced ahead of his men, bellowing his anger and swinging his broad sword above his head. An arrow sliced into his thigh, but he ignored it. Lennox leapt from the line to meet him, holding a long-handled mace of lead and iron. He too threw aside his shield as Orsa ran forward, slashing his blade towards the clansman's head. Lennox made no move to avoid the blow, but lashed the mace into the blade, smashing it to shards. Orsa crashed into him, and both men fell to the ground, Orsa's hands closing about Lennox's throat. Releasing the mace, Lennox reached up to cup his hand under Orsa's chin, Then punching his arm forward, he snapped the Aenean's head back, tearing the man's grip from his neck. Rolling, Lennox came up with a mace and delivered a terrible blow to Orthus' skull, crushing the bones to shards and powder. With scant seconds to spare, Lennox rejoined the line, standing beside his father Leophas and the Palades warlord Magrig. The front line of the Aenea bore down on the waiting clans. Magrig lifted his sword, grinned at Intosh, then screamed the battle cry of the Palades. Cut, cut, cut! The chant was taken up, and the clans surged into the charging Aenea. After 4 years of war in the lowlands, the Aenea believed they were the finest fighters under the sky. But never had they met the fierce-eyed, blood-hungry wolves of the mountains. Now they learned the terrible truth, and as the blades of the clan slashed and cut their first line to shreds, the charge faltered. Magrig powered his way into the Aenea ranks, cleaving and killing, an awful fury upon him. Many were the Palades dead, whose faces he would never forget, whose souls hungered for vengeance. The warlord forgot the plan to hold the center and forged ever deeper into the enemy. Intosh and the Palades had no choice but to follow him. Leophas gutted one warrior and parried a blow from a second, backhanding his shield into the man's face. Lennox aided him, braining the man with his mace.
"Sound the horn!" yelled Leophas. "Magrig's gone mad!"
Lennox stepped back from the fray, allowing Farlan warriors to shield him from the enemy. Lifting his warhorn to his lips, he blew 3 sharp blasts. The sound filtered through Magrig's rage, and he slowed in his attack, allowing the Palades to form around him. The weight of the Aenea numbers was beginning to tell, and the clans were pushed back, inch by murderous inch. The deadly storm of arrows had slowed now, for the archers on the slopes were running short of shafts. Dunild hurled aside his bow, lifting his shield and drawing his sword. His men followed suit. Now was the time to withdraw, for the battle could not be won. The Aenea had not broken. 300 clansmen joined him, swords in hand. Looking across the slopes to where his enemy, Patris Grigor, had also drawn his sword, Dunild felt a strange calm settle on him. He lifted his sword in silent farewell to his enemy. There would never be peace while they both lived, for their hatred was stronger than any desire to beat a common foe.
"Cut, cut, cut!"
yelled Dunild, and led his 300 down the slope to reinforce the Farlan. Patris Grigor could not believe his eyes. His enemy of 20 years had just surrendered his lands. Patris was now the undisputed lord of the Northwest.
"What does he think he's doing?"
yelled a man on his left. Grigor shrugged. 20 years of hatred, and now Dunald was hurling his life away on a futile charge in a doomed battle. Grigor shook his head and dropped his bow.
"Do you leave now?"
asked a clansman. Grigor laughed.
"You know what's happening down there.
The Aenea are about to win through. It's all over."
"That's right. And that brainless idiot Dunald has gone down there today."
"Then we are leaving."
"What do you think?"
The man grinned.
"If we charge now, he might just be able to hack our way through to Dunald, and then, while no one's looking, I'll cut his throat."
Grigor chuckled and hitched his shield to his arm.
"Yes, by damn, let's do something noble for a change."
Raising his sword, he began to run down the slope. 500 Grigor warriors took up their swords and followed him. The front line of the Aenea slipped and slithered over blood-covered rocks and sprawled bodies, only to be cut down by the slashing iron blades of the clansmen. Leophas, his cold blue eyes glinting with battle fever, stood at the center of the defenders, Magrig and Lennox on either side. Again and again the Aenea swarmed forward, only to be turned back by the sharp blades and steadfast courage of the defenders. Drada, alone among the Aenea, was not surprised by the resolute defense. But he had been a part of many battles, and knew what must happen now. The clans would fall back. There was no choice. Their strength was failing fast, and their losses were enormous. The two at the center were both old men, and their stamina suspect.
Once they had fallen, the line would break. Beside him, Brigger was poised for the final rush. He had been a warrior for more than 20 years, and always he knew there came a point where the fight could be read like a game, where the ebb and flow could be charted like a steady current. They had reached that point now, and the clans were ready to break. The feeling swept among the Anir, and the battle cries began again. Once more the forces clashed. The clansmen fought silently now, leaden-legged and heavy of arm, and inch by inexorable inch they were forced back towards the open pass beyond. Brigger felt joy surge in his veins. No army in the world could hold now. It was over. The clans were finished. Margaret felt it too, and he cursed aloud as he clove his sword through an Anir neck and ducked under a slashing blade. Well, if he had to die, he was damned if it would be in the open ground he had fought so hard to defend. Dropping to his haunches, he hurled himself forward into the Anir, cutting and stabbing. Caught up in the frenzy of the moment, Leofas joined him with Lennox and Intosh, and the clans rallied, surging forward to join their leaders. The ferocity of the assault stunned the leading Anir warriors, and they fought to pull back. Brigger, just behind the front line, turned to Drada.
"It's impossible,"
he shouted. Drada shrugged. As the Anir front line backed away from him, Margrig raised his sword defiantly.
"Come on, you outland scum! We're still standing!"
A huge warrior in a wolf's head helm leapt from the Anir ranks, sword raised. Margrig parried the blow and reversed a cut to the warrior's neck. The blade hammered into the mail shirt and snapped. Dropping the useless hilt, Margrig grabbed the man by his mail shirt and hauled him forward, butting him savagely and crashing his fist into the man's belly. The warrior doubled over, his head snapping back, as Margrig's knee came up to explode against his face. Intosh threw Margrig a sword. Margrig caught it by the hilt and sliced the blade through the back of the wolf's head helm. The Anir died without a sound.
"You lice-ridden sons of bitches!" shouted Margrig. "Is that the best you can do?"
A roar rose from the Anir, and the line lunged forward. The battle raged once more, and now there were no blood-curdling battle cries, only the screams of the dying and the grim determination of the living to survive. The clansmen had been forced back, but their enemies had to climb a wall of their own dead to force a path to the dwindling band of defenders. Asbadag had climbed into the saddle, the better to see the battle. His trained eye knew it had reached its final stage. A carl beside him screamed suddenly, pitching forward to the ground, with a black feathered shaft in his back. Arrows hissed through the air around him. Asbadag swung in the saddle, tearing his shield from the saddle horn. At the mouth of the pass, Galen lifted his war horn and blew 3 blasts. 800 bows were bent, and a dark cloud of shafts ripped into the horde. Margrig crushed his shield into the face of an attacker, hurling him from his feet, lancing his blade into a second man and dragging it clear.
"It's Galen!" shouted Lennox. "He must have 1,000 men with him!"
Margrig staggered as an axe blade shattered his shield. He hammered his fist into the axeman's face, feeling the man's teeth break under the impact. A lean Anir swordsman pushed himself past Margrig. Leofas blocked his blow, but lost his grip on the sword. Grabbing the man by the neck and groin, he hoisted him into the air and hurled him back amongst his comrades. The man vanished into the mass. Leofas recovered his blade, wincing as a sword cut into his shoulder. Lennox leapt to the rescue, his blood-covered club smashing the swordsman's spine. At the mouth of the pass, Galen signalled for the women to scale the slopes on either side of the fighting men. Lara set off to the right with 400 Hasten women behind her. As she climbed, Galen turned to Taylor. "Now, let's see what you can do with that blade," he said. Hitching his shield into place, Galen ran at Asbadag's carls, 100 Palladese warriors yelling their war cry behind him. His horse rearing and kicking, Asbadag saw death running at him. An arrow knocked his helm from his head, another thudded into his shield. Panic overwhelmed him.
Kicking his heels to his horse's side, he rode through his own men, smashing their line, then veered away from the advancing clansmen. Arrows hissed around him, and he ducked low over the horse's neck. Lara saw his flight and notched an arrow to the string, drawing smoothly and sighting on Asbadag's broad back. The shaft sang through the air, punching through the Aeneas male shirt at the shoulder. Then he was through and clear and riding south. His horse carried him for a mile before collapsing and pitching him to the earth. He rolled to his feet. Three arrows had pierced the beast's chest and belly. Leaving it to die, Asbadag began the long walk south. In the folly, Asbadag's panicked flight had opened the way for Galen and his warriors to smash the shield wall and engage the carls. Galen ducked under a two-handed cut and drove his sword home into the man's chest. Beside him, Taylor leapt and twisted, his sword flashing in the sunlight, cleaving and killing. Two men ran at Galen. He blocked a blow from the first, gutting the man with a reverse stroke. His sword stuck in his opponent's belly. He saw the second warrior's sword arcing towards his head. Taylor parried the blow, chopping his blade through the man's neck. The burly Palades grinned.
"Be more careful, Fallen. I can't be watching out for both of us."
In the valley, all was chaos, as Drada fought to hold the Aeneas steady. Arrows rained upon them from both sides of the pass, and the clans were fighting like men possessed. But it was a losing battle. Drada could feel that success was but a matter of moments ahead. Once they pushed the enemy back into the wider pass beyond, nothing could prevent an Aeneas victory. Glancing about him, the young Aeneas warrior was horrified at the losses his force had suffered. Considerably more than half his warriors were down. 12,000 men sacrificed to Asbadag's stupidity. But against this, Drada had seen his father's flight, and it filled him with joy. No need to kill him now and risk death from his carls. No Aeneas would follow him ever again. He would be a wolf's head, disowned and disregarded. Now Drada would have it all. The army, the land, and the magic gates. He would build the greatest empire the world had ever seen.
"On! On!" he yelled. "The last yard!"
And it was true. The Aeneas pushed forward once more. Margrig fell, slashed across the thigh. From the ground he stabbed upward, gutting his attacker. A blow sliced towards his head, but Intosh blocked it, and died, an axe cleaving his skull. Margrig staggered to his feet, plunging his blade through the axeman's chest. A sword lanced his side and he stepped back, lashing out weakly. Lennox bludgeoned a path to stand alongside him, mace dripping blood. Above the noise of battle came the sound of distant horns. Then they felt the ground beneath their feet tremble, and the rolling thunder of galloping hooves echoed in the mountains. For a moment, all battle ceased, as men craned to see the mouth of the pass. A huge dust cloud swirled there, and out of it rode 4,000 fighting men with lances levelled. At the centre was a warrior in silver armour. In her hand was a mighty sword of shimmering steel.
"The queen comes!" yelled Leofas.
Magrig could not believe his eyes. Blood streamed from the wound in his side and his injured leg, and he stepped back from the fray, allowing two Palades warriors to join shields before him. Slowly he climbed to the top of a pitted boulder, narrowing his eyes to see the horsemen. The Aeneas moved back from the clan line, straining to identify the new foe. Drada was stunned. What he was seeing was an impossibility. There were no cavalry forces on this part of the continent. But it was no illusion. The thunder of hooves grew, and the Aeneas warriors, facing the charge, scrambled towards the rocky slopes on either side of the pass. Their comrades behind them threw aside their weapons and tried to run. Other, more stout-hearted fighters gripped their swords more tightly and raised their shields. It mattered not whether they ran or stood. The terrible lances bore down upon them, splintering shields and lifting men from their feet, dashing them bloody and broken to the dusty ground. Horses reared, iron-shod hooves thrashing down, crashing skulls and trampling the wounded. The Anir broke, streaming up onto the slopes, into the flashing shafts of the Hasten women. Leofas urged the Fallen forward, shearing his sword into the confused mass before him. The battle became a rout. Anir warriors threw down their weapons, begging for mercy, but there was none. With swords in their hands or without, the Anir were cut to pieces. Dunald and Grigor fought side by side now, the remnants of their clans blood-covered and battle-crazed, hacking and slashing their way forward. The Anir struggled to reform. Grada sounded the war horn, and the shield ring grew around him. An arrow punched through Tostig's helm to skewer his skull. With a bellow of rage and pain, he slumped to the ground beside his brother. Grada raised his shield. Sigarni, her silver steel blade dripping crimson, wheeled her grey stallion and led her men back down the pass. The Anir watched them go, sick with horror. At the mouth of the folly, the queen turned again, and the thunder of charging hooves drowned the despairing cries of the enemy. Thrice more she charged, and the shield ring shattered. A lean Anir warrior ran forward, ducking under Sigarni's plunging sword, stabbing his own blade into the horse's belly. It screamed and fell, rolling across the man who had ended its life, killing him as it died. Sigarni was thrown to the ground in the midst of the Anir. She came up swinging the double-handed sword, beheading the first warrior to leap to the attack. The Anir closed around her. Galen and Tello, fighting side by side, saw the queen go down. "No!" screamed Galen. He cut his opponent from him and raced into the mass. Taylor followed him, with Agwaine and Onik and a dozen Palades.
"Hold on, my lady!" yelled Galen.
Sigarni flashed a glance towards him, momentarily puzzled, then blocked a slashing attack from a longsword. Twisting her wrists and returning the blow, she clove the man from collarbone to belly. But the Anir were all around her now. She swung and twisted, and too late, saw a blade slashing towards her neck. Galen's sword flashed up, parrying the death blow.
"I am here, my lady!"
he shouted above the clash of iron on iron. Sigarni grinned and returned to the business of death. Drada, with all hope of victory gone, tried to forge a path to the mouth of the pass. Beside him his carl Captain Briga fought on, though a score of minor cuts poured blood from his arms and thighs.
"I think we are done, Drada," shouted Briga. "But by Vatten, there's been some blood spilled today."
Drada did not answer. Ahead of them, a woman had climbed to a tall boulder and drawn back her bow. The arrow hissed through the air, thudding into Drada's throat, and with a look of surprise, the Anir leader fell sideways. Briga tried to catch him, but a sword slid between his ribs, and he jerked upright. He did not know it, nor would he have cared, but he was one of the last Anir still alive in the folly. His breath rasped in his throat, and he dropped his sword as a great rushing noise filled his ears. Around him, the pass was choked with bodies of the fallen, and Briga thought he could see the Valkyrie descending from the sky, the winged horses and the chariots of black. What tales he would tell in the Hall of the Dead. He toppled from his feet, eyes still fixed on the black mass of crows and buzzards circling in the sky overhead. Far to the south, Asbedag, unaware of the clan victory, entered a thickly wooded section of hills. He was breathing heavily and tired to the bone. Stopping by a stream, he tore the arrow from his shoulder and stripped his mail shirt from him. He leaned over the water to drink. Looking down, he saw his reflection, and just above it, a face out of a nightmare. Asbedag rolled to his back, scrabbling for his knife, but the werehound's talons snaked down, ripping his throat to shreds. Blood bubbled from the ruined jugular, and the creature's jaws opened. Asbadag's eyes widened as the fangs flashed down. The creature backed away from the body and squatted on its haunches, staring down at the ruined face. In its mind, vague memories stirred, and a low whine came from its throat. Pictures danced and flickered, racing ahead of the pack, and the horsemen leaping at the stag as it turned to face them, curling up in the day by the stables warm and comfortable. But other, stranger images confused it. A young woman, with fair hair, smiling, her head resting on a cotton pillow. A child running, laughing, hands stretching towards it. Lifting its head, the beast howled its despair at the night sky. Then moving back to the corpse, the creature stretched out its talon claw, pulling the dagger loose from the sheath. Turning the point to its breast, it plunged the blade home. Pain. Terrible. Pain. Then peace. Oberyn found her, hiding behind a boulder. He was tempted to slit her throat and be done with it. Sorely tempted. He knew what she was, had always known. The tall rider dragged her out by her hair. She was strangely quiescent, and her eyes were hooded and distant.
"I'd like to kill you," he hissed.
Holding her hair, he led her past the bodies and out to the plain. Sigani was seated on a high-backed saddle, placed before a small fire. She was drinking wine from a copper goblet and chatting to three of her lancers. She glanced up as Oberyn hurled the woman to the ground at her feet.
"A surprise, my lady," said Oberyn. "She was with the Aenir, I'm told."
Sigani stood and pulled her gently to her feet.
"How are you, Morgasa?" she asked.
The raven-haired woman shrugged.
"As you see me. Alone."
"I know how that feels," said Sigani. "Accept that the war is over, and you may return with us. I shall restore you to your father's lands."
"In return for what? My promise of allegiance? My mother's soul would scream out against it. You saw my father slain, my mother raped. Kill me, Sigarni, or I will haunt you to your grave."
Oberyn's sword hissed from its scabbard.
"This once, I'll agree with a bitch,"
he said.
"Give the word, my lady."
Sigarni shook her head.
"Fetch her horse.
Let her ride where she will."
Two soldiers took hold of Morgasa and led her away. Twisting in their grip, she shouted out,
"I will find a way back, Sigarni, and then you will pay."
"Your decision burdens my spirit," said Oberyn. "She is evil, Sigarni. There is no good in her."
"There is little good in any of us. We love and we die by the grace of God. A great wrong was done to her. It twisted her mind, as once such a deed twisted mine."
By dusk, the druids had come out from hiding in the woods around the folly and had begun to administer to the wounded clansmen. Magrig, 10 stitches in his side and 12 more in his thigh, sat on a boulder staring at the fluttering crows, who were leaping and squawking over the stripped bodies of the slain. The clan dead had been carried out of the folly and laid together on the plain. A cairn would be built tomorrow. So many dead. Of the 800 Palades, only 200 survived, many of these with grievous wounds. More than 1,000 Farlan warriors had died, and another 400 from the Loda and Dunilds. By a twist of fate, both leaders had survived, fighting at the last, back to back. Magrig sighed. The place looked like a charnel house. Leofas, his wounds stitched and bandaged, joined him at the boulder.
Well, we won,
he said.
Yes, and we old ones survive. So many young men gone to dust, and we old bulls sit here and breathe free air.
Leofa shrugged.
Aye, but we are a canny pair.
Magra grinned.
Have you seen Caswellan?
No.
Come on, let's seek out the Queen. The least we can do is thank her.
Leofas helped Magrig to his feet, and the two made their way through the bodies. The crows, belly full and heavy with meat, hopped out of their way, too laden to fly. At the mouth of the pass beyond the tethered mounts were the campfires of Sigani's lancers, set in a circle at the centre of which sat the Queen and her captains. Sigani rose as the clansmen approached. "Pour wine for them, Oberyn," she told her captain. Magrig thrust out his hand.
"Thank you, my lady. You've saved my people."
"I am glad we were here in time. I owe much to Red Hawk, and it was a relief to part settle the score."
"Where is Caswellan?"
asked Magrig. "I know not," said the Queen. "He asked us to meet him at the island of Valon." Two riders brought high-backed saddles, which they placed on the ground for the clansmen.
"Be seated," said Sigani. "I wish to meet one of your clansmen. He saved my life today."
"I think it will be hard to find one clansman," said Leofas.
"Not this one. He has a blaze of white hair above his left eye, and the eye itself is full of blood."
"I know him," said Leofas. "If he loves, I will send him to you."
Oberyn brought mulled wine, and they drank in silence for a while. The following morning, as work began on the cairn, most of the lancers had returned home through the gate, which had appeared in a blaze of light on the plain the night before. Sigani remained behind with 20 men, including Oberyn. Leofas had found Galen, sitting hand in hand with a Hasten girl in the woods skirting the mountains.
"Well met, young Galen," he said.
Galen rose, introducing Lara to the older man. Leofas bowed.
"I have seen you before, girl, but never prettier than now."
"Thank you. I am glad you survived," said Lara.
"We might not have done, had you not appeared with your archers."
"A freak of chance," Lara told him. "We struck north to avoid the Aenir, and that meant we had to pass the Folly. How is it that the Queen arrived? Galen told me she was due at Axter Glen, and that's a day's ride from here."
Leofas shrugged.
"I don't know, neither does the Queen. Caswellan's the man to answer the riddle. Now, get a move on, boy. The Queen wishes to see you." "But tell me,
where is Lane?" Galen looked into the old man's eyes, but could find no words. The smile faded from Leofas's face, and he looked suddenly so very old. The white-bearded warrior sighed.
"So many dead,"
he whispered.
"Tell me how it happened."
Galen did so,
and could find no way to disguise the horror of Lane's passing.
Leofas listened in silence, then turned away and walked off alone towards the trees. Galen watched him and felt the comforting touch of Lara's hand.
"Come," she said. "The Queen wishes to see you."
He nodded, and together they approached the Queen's camp. Sigani strode out to meet him, hand outstretched.
"Good to see you alive, my lad. There are a few questions I have for you."
Galen bowed, introducing Lara. The Queen smiled warmly at the clanswoman.
"No, what were you doing risking yourself to save me?"
she asked, turning on Galen, her grey eyes glinting with humour.
"I expect that from my lancers, but not from strangers."
"I owe you my life," said Galen simply.
"For coming here with my lancers, you mean?"
"No, lady, but I cannot speak of it. Forgive me."
"More secrets of the Enchanted Realm?" You sound like Red Hawk. All right, Galen. I shall not press you. How can I reward you for your action? Galen stared at her, remembering the day she had saved them from the beast. In that instant, he knew where his road must lead. Dropping to one knee before the warrior queen, he said, "Let me serve you, my lady, now and forever." Ifsigani was surprised she did not show it. "You will have to leave this realm," said the queen, "and fight beside me in a war that is naught of your making. Do you desire this?" "I do, my queen, more than anything. I love this land, but I have seen my friends slaughtered, their homes burnt and their children massacred." "Then rise, for my friends do not kneel before me. They walk beside me." "Will your lady come too?" she asked, turning to Lara. Galen rose and took her hand. "Will you?" "Where else would I go?" she answered. "I love you," he whispered, pulling her to him. The queen moved away from them then, joining Oberyn at the fire. With the high cairn now covering the clan dead, Leofas led the survivors back to Attafos. Despite the victory, the men were heavy of heart. Their loved ones were lost in the past, their friends dead in the present. Magrig rode beside Sigani, while Galen and Lara joined Lennox, Onik, Agwain, and Gwalchmai at the head of the column. Galen was the only one of the surviving beast slayers to have emerged unscathed from the battle. Lennox carried a score of stitches, while Gwalchmai had taken a spear in the shoulder. Agwain had been stabbed in the leg, and he walked with a painful limp. "Are you really going to go with the queen?" asked Agwain, "and leave the mountains?" "Yes," answered Galen. "I promised her years ago that I would follow her."
"Will she take me too, do you think?" Gwalchmai asked.
"I believe so." "I shall not go," said Agwain. "There is much to do here."
"Without Lane, there is little to hold me here,"
said Lennox sadly.
"I'll come with you, Galen."
An hour before dusk, the column arrived at the invisible bridge to Valon and spread out along the banks. A man appeared on the far shore. A tall man with greying hair, wearing a velvet robe the colour of dark wine. He lifted his hand. Glittering lights rose from the water to hover in the air around the invisible bridge, which darkened, gleaming like silver in the fading light. Stronger and stronger grew the bridge as the light coalesced, shimmering and sparkling, until at last it seemed built of silver and gems. The man lifted his hand once more, and stepped out upon the silver walkway. From behind him came the men and women of the Farlan and the Pallades. A great silence settled on the clansmen, as hope flared again in their hearts. The man approached, his grey streaked hair billowing in the breeze. He was full bearded, and his eyes were the green of a distant sea.
"Caswellan!"
shouted Galen, running forward to meet him. Caswellan opened his arms, tears sparkling in his eyes. The two men hugged one another warmly. Then Galen pulled back to look at his foster father. Caswellan seemed to have aged 10 years since last they met.
"What has happened to you?" whispered Galen.
"We will talk later. First, let us enjoy the reunion."
Wives and children ran to husbands and fathers, sons and brothers, and laughter swelled through the trees of Atta Forest.
"Long time since that sound was heard," said Caswellan.
Meg was one of the last across the bridge. Silently she approached her husband, little Donal beside her, riding on the back of the great hound Render.
"Leave us for a while, Galen. I will see you later,"
said Caswellan. He took Meg's hand, kissing her palm.
Her eyes were full of tears, and she leaned into him. "What have they done to you?" she asked, holding back the sorrow and stroking his graying hair.